So the last part of this is about groupware toolkits. So this is the usual process where you go into an area where you explore new possibilities. So the first systems that were built for shared editing, like Grove and others, were just designed from scratch. And after a while, you have some concepts and the principles that emerge. In the case of shared editing, there is this concurrency algorithms we talked about. And so the idea then is to put that into some library or toolkit or some things to make the life of those who want to build such applications easier. And so in the 90s, as you can see here, there was quite a bit of activity to create a number of toolkits for shared editing, but for groupware in general, shared editing in particular. So the idea was to, in the same way as traditional toolkits for graphical user interfaces provide widgets to simplify the task of building interfaces, the idea here was to provide groupware widgets to support a number of things that are found in many groupware systems, particularly to support group awareness, and also to provide a number of services that you need to build groupware systems. So there's a number of them here. This edit was a toolkit for distributed editing of text. I think it was working with Emacs. Suite was more like middleware, offering a number of tools to that allow you to control different levels of coupling between the various participants. Rendezvous was another middleware for organizing essentially shared group activities. GroupKit is the one I'm going to talk about a little bit more. There's another few ones here. But I have to say that it's again a case where this was early work, and even though GroupKit, for example, was the most advanced toolkit for groupware, to my knowledge, nothing really exists today that is modern versions of these things. So GroupKit was developed at the University of Calgary, which is Calgary. What country is that? No idea. What? Canada, yes. Yes. Sort of. Not quite as far as Vancouver, but on the way there. And so at the University of Calgary, there's a group led by Saul Greenberg, who has done a lot of work in CSCW in general. And his lab, Group Lab, if you look it up on the web, you'll see a number of things that they've done. So they developed this toolkit at the time in Tickle TK, which was a scripting language that had a graphical toolkit called TK, which was, I've used Tickle TK a lot for teaching because it was a nice combination of the ability to write interfaces that were not trivial without spending too much time. And TK had two widgets in particular, the text widget and the canvas widget, that were in fact more powerful than what you have, even to my knowledge, in things like JavaSwing today. And it was fairly easy to create a groupware because a little Tickle, you had access to Unix and so to things like sockets and things like this. But it was always built as a sort of research and teaching tool. It was not meant to be a commercial toolkit or something to build commercial applications. It was more a proof of concept. So it's, I think, in fact, I checked, it's still available today, groupkit.org. So what it has is a level of middleware for session management, where there's still some more French here, where it manages people coming into a session, leaving a session, and when someone enters a session, it gets transmitted the state of the session, wherever that is. It supports data distribution, although they never really implemented sophisticated consistency algorithms. And its strength really is to support a number of widgets for collaborative interaction. So the way it works is that it's a hybrid architecture where you have a centralized part and a replicated part. So the registrar is the centralized part to the whole system. Every time you want to connect and enter sessions and all that, you need to go through the registrar. And then there's another part that is also centralized, if you wish, is that each user, so each personal computer, has a session manager. And the session manager communicates with the registrar. That's how the system knows who is connected and available for sessions. And then each, what they call conference, is really a groupware tool that runs with a replicated architecture. So the centralized part is used to launch a new conference, tell which are the participants, and then the communication is directly from conference to conference. So one of the things they were trying to do was to say, well, you know, when we build a regular GUI application, we have all these widgets that we just glue together to build the application. So when we build groupware applications, we need to support extra functionalities, including awareness. And so they did a lot of work on what it means to support awareness. So it goes from who is participating, where the list of users that are available or in a conference, where are they physically, what can they see, so controlling the level of coupling and what things are shared. Then there is the sort of what they do, what is their activity level, what do they actually do, what are the specific actions they do, and what do they need to accomplish those actions. And maybe awareness also, high level, task level, what are they going to do, what can they do. So this was solved by a number of widgets and features of the toolkit. Telepointers, as we talked about before, so to show the pointer of other users. Multi-scroll bars, which in a sense is a form of telepointer because it shows you where the others are in the document. Radar views and fisheye views are two types of views that gives you an overview of, say, big documents, so you know where the others are and sometimes what they are doing. So this is an example of telepointers. So we have a shared editing session here where we see two cursors. Now these are text cursors. So the idea when you do text editing is it is in fact distracting if you see all the movement of the mouse cursor, and showing the text cursor usually is enough. However, what they do here is something on top of that is as you see, the text has different font sizes. This is because it's zooming in around the place where you are and where the others are, and zooming out the places where there's nobody. So it's a way in a long document to see where the others are more in context than, you know, if everything were the same size, this would be outside the window, you wouldn't see it. And that's something, you know, if you activate telepointers in a shared text thing, you could configure to have this automatic zooming feature or not, depending on whether you want it or not. So these are the multi-scroll bars. The way it works is, that's the case where this scroll bar is a regular TK scroll bar, and you can't modify identify it. So what they did is they added next to it a display showing what the other users are viewing. So this is a very short document, as we can see, the scroll bar here shows that we see most of it. And so the other people's scroll bars are also very, very big. I believe there was a way to lock your scroll bar to someone else's. So this way you could synchronize and have more view, what's it called, the view congruence, thank you, between two users. So that's a nice feature because it means you control the level of coupling, so either I scroll independently or we decide to scroll together. So here's the radar view. The way it was implemented is when you had the radar view activated, it would show the whole document in sort of gray overlay with a square around, I guess, the view of the different users. And apparently here there's only one user. So the idea was to do this in the same window rather than a separate window just to save space. And the idea was that for a document like this graphical document, having it sort of in this washed out representation would be visible without being too disturbing. And it's, again, something with the collaboration menu here that you could activate or deactivate. So the feature view is something I already alluded to with the multiple cursors. So in the text view, the text could be zoomed in and out according to the cursors or the focus of the other users, as well as the focus of the local user. We also see on this screenshot the session tool. So when you launch the session tool on your machine, it gives you this window where you can see which conferences are active and for each one which are the participants. And then with I guess one of the menus, you can say I want to enter the conference, and there was, you know, conferences could be open or closed. Not to enter, someone has to authorize you, or it could be open. So that's the session tool, and I guess what we see here is the way to control the fisheye, so the scaling of the text in this fisheye view. So they build a lot of, little to medium-sized applications with GroupKit. Of course, they did the brainstorming text chat tool for brainstorming. They did the various drawing tools for, you know, whether it was bitmaps or vector-based drawing. We saw a little bit of graph editing. They did file browsers, text editors, and little games. So it was, you know, just to show. Not that it was possible to build these things, but to show that it was easy to build these things. So, I think conclusion for me to this part of shared editing is, why isn't shared editing everywhere? Why hasn't it become something we take for granted, like we take for granted, you know, undo and redo, or we take for granted the fact that you know, number of features you have in applications. And I don't have a good answer to this. I think the problem is, for shared editing to take on, we have to make it so it works in heterogeneous environments. As soon as you're forcing everyone to use the same tool, it's not going to work, I think. I personally hate it when people say, oh, I've put that in a Google Doc. Frankly, the interface, the Google Docs, sucks. I don't want to have to relearn where the menu is to put something bold, or where the shortcut is, or this or that. So, and you know, I mean, some people are happy to do it, but it shouldn't force everyone to go through the same tool. So it should be based on open standards, so it can interoperate. And of course, I can imagine that if we're all in the same tool, we have extra features that we don't have if we are different tools. That's okay, you know, that you cannot make everything 100% compatible, but there should be some basic level where we should at least be able to do text, shared text editing, whichever editor we're using.
I feel that the version control system have taken over this goal, in fact, because everybody is free to use his favorite editor and still can synchronize in some way.
Well, with the version control systems, you are in a asynchronous mode. So, plus the system, you know, does some level of conflict resolution as long as the changes don't overlap. But if there are conflicts when you update the repository, it tells you, well, you have to fix the conflict. So, I mean, maybe the this could be used in a more interactive way, and then maybe the check-ins could be done automatically or things like this. It is true that the version control systems are more agnostic about which tool you use. So yeah, but inherently they're built as asynchronous systems. So the transition to real time.
Yeah, sure. Well, I just feel that it's the main trend right now. I'm not saying this is good.
Yeah.
And that's why the main trend is cloud-based editing. No.
Sorry?
The main trend is the cloud.
Well, so that's my second line here, is that there seems to be a general assumption that to move to shared, to groupware tools, you have to put your documents in the cloud. So this is what Google does with the Google Docs, but this is what Microsoft is doing with so I don't know, they change name every 6 months, or is it still Microsoft 360, or... Anyway, so they, and in fact, Apple had started to work on this, I don't know, it's sort of disappeared, and I think it's going to come back at some point, but they take their desktop applications, then they rebuild them as web applications, and they put sharing in them. And the net result of this is the documents are not on my machine anymore. I don't know really who has access to it. I have to trust Google or Microsoft or Apple to, you know, keep my documents secure. I know that, you know, we work at the university, we work on contracts with industry, you know, they wouldn't let us have any kinds of documents in the cloud. They even get nervous when we use Doodle to set up a meeting. So there is the issue. No, but I think it is a very, very serious issue, because it's done in the name of convenience, but I don't see what the convenience, because I don't have my documents when I'm not online, which is a lot of the time, you know, when you travel or and I don't see what you gain really out of it. I think it's a way for them to lock you into a system, even their system, even more. So I don't think that you need to go into cloud-based infrastructure to support groupware. And in fact, a lot of the algorithms that I've talked about are purely distributed. They can be really peer-to-peer. And it's true that a lot of the time when you come to storing the document, it goes to a central server and it's stored in the central server. But even that you have to do. You could, each one could store their copy and make it work this way. So, I don't know. I mean, I think we're seeing. I got recently the new suite from Adobe, and the same thing. Now they have the Photoshop and all these things on in the cloud, and their model, of course, is it's free at first, and then they want to charge you monthly. So I think that's the big motivation behind the cloud is people have realized that by selling software once every 2 years when there's a new release is not good enough for them to make money. So now we're going to rent software and you're going to pay by the month to have access to software. Plus, it gives them the ability to upgrade the thing all the time. I mean, at least on my desktop computer, I can decide if I upgrade to the next version or not. But with cloud stuff, you download, and you launch a web application one day, and the next day it's different, and you have no control over this. So I don't know. I find this very sad and annoying. So I mean, the positive way of looking at this is, I think there's tremendous opportunity there to do some new things. What is it doing?
Yeah, Tony, if you have the marketing power to advertise, then otherwise there are so big companies that can't really fight.
I think there is room to do something disruptive, and I don't know what it is. I mean, it's going to have to be not necessarily more, but different from the obvious things. But I think there is space to do something disruptive in the way that Facebook and Twitter were disruptive in a space where, I mean, we had chat and things and short messages for forever. So why is it that suddenly they were able to do these big things? I'm not quite sure, but...
Marketing, you need to...
But marketing, yeah. The thing is, when I hear marketing, I hear big ad campaigns and forcing things on people. I think the success of Facebook and Twitter,
big campaigns, but subtle buzz.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Facebook and Twitter and MySpace, even though now it's pretty much dead, but these early things, they grew by word of mouth, and I think that's the way you start, and then things get bigger. But you don't see advertisement for Facebook or Twitter. I mean, they don't need it at this point. They didn't spend money on advertising. I think all the startups that spend 80% of their venture capital funding to advertise for their systems are just crazy, because that's not how you build a business. I mean, I'm not the right person to give advice on business stuff, but I don't think that's the way it works. No, I really think that here someone could come up with a clever idea. I think it will require quite a bit of work, because as we saw, it's not trivial to build these things, whereas Facebook or Twitter is really trivial to build, except when you need to really scale it. But that doesn't happen immediately. So here I think it's a little bit more complicated, but the knowledge is out there, because the basic research work has been done for this. I think the problem is, it gets back to this collaboration transparent versus collaboration aware. How do we make it so it works enough with some existing tools, so people won't feel like, oh, I have to learn a new thing. So
we need the standard first.
Yeah. And you need something open from day one, so that anybody can so that quickly people can say, oh, I'm going to do this little piece of work in my system, so it does work in this ecosystem. And so that sort of transitions to what I wanted to talk quickly about now, which is also, and the primary reason I did it was for the project I would like you to work on. So if you want to build groupware today, I wouldn't use GroupKit. I mean, I'm sure it still works, but it's a little bit dated. And I think, in a sense, the web is a decent infrastructure. It's not perfect by any means, and you will have to tweak it. But I think it has the advantage that it's available everywhere. The big issue with the groupware stuff is if the first thing you have to do when you install your new groupware tool is go see your staff and tell them, oh, can you open this port for me because I need to run the system, that, you know, they will not like it. So by using web infrastructure, you know, you can get a lot of stuff go through the web without annoying your security people and networking people. And of course, it's by nature distributed, so it has a number of things that we can leverage to build groupware tools. And there are a bunch of examples out there of systems that are. So, if you're going to program stuff on the web, you're going to use JavaScript. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. The thing is, JavaScript is a much better language than you think. I don't know what you think, but I can tell you it's better than what you think. Because I've been using JavaScript for a while now, and it's still better than I think. So. And the problem is, JavaScript came out has a language that people use without knowing how it works. So what you see is all around the web, you know, pieces of JavaScript scripts that do things, usually poorly, but they do the job. Also, JavaScript people don't understand what is JavaScript, the language, from JavaScript, the embedding in the web browser, and they confuse things a lot. And I don't blame them because, again, there's no... First, if you want to see, you know, as a computer scientist, the way to learn JavaScript, for me, is to go see the spec of the language. Because I understand if, you know, they explain things to me in terms of the semantics of what this thing does, as opposed to random examples that are usually poorly written. So the thing is, if you want to see the spec of JavaScript, you won't find it by googling for JavaScript. You have to google for ECMAScript, which is the official name, and there you'll find documents that give you the full semantics of the language, and you'll understand things that no website, actually no easily accessible website will tell you. And ECMAScript. Because it's a standard now, and ECMA is the name of the standardization body, and they call it ECMAScript. So, it's a functional and object-oriented language. Functional, that means that you can write functions. You can write functions that return functions, that take functions as arguments. And functions are first-class objects. So, this is a very trivial example. We have a mapping function that takes an array and a function, and it will go through the array and apply the function to each element and accumulate the result in the sum. So if I call map on the array 1, 2, 3, mapping the function that maps x to x squared, then I compute the sum of squares. Have you guys done any functional programming? ML, CAML? Yes? Okay, so, I mean, pretty much everything you can do in CAML, you can do in JavaScript. I mean, here I'm not pretending to teach you anything about any of these things, just to give you an overview. Then it's object-oriented. And when I mean object-oriented, it means that it does not mean that it's what usually people think of an object-oriented language is, because it does not have classes. So, you can declare an object. Here is an object that's P for point. It has two, they call it properties. x and y. X is 10, y is 25. But properties can also be a function. So move by is a property, and it's a function. And when I define a function like this in the context of an object, I have the keyword z, this, which refers to the object that this is being applied to. So the function move by takes two arguments and move increases the x and y by dx and dy. So now I have my point P, and I can do P dot move by 5, 10. That means that I have an object where the method is in the object. It's not in the class. So I could have another object that has a move by function in it that does something completely different. So this is called, in the galaxy of object-oriented stuff, it's called prototype based as opposed to class based, because in fact there is something that allows you to share stuff between objects. Because if you think of it, object-oriented programming is really just that. It's really that you have individual state for each object, but all the objects in the same class share the same methods. Now, in a prototype-based system, the sharing you can do is much more general. You can share not only methods, but properties, and it's more flexible in a way. So with a prototype-based language, which JavaScript is, you can build a class-based language. The other way around, you can't. So that's one of the reasons why JavaScript is more powerful than many other things out there. So the way it works is that, in fact, and that's a problem, a little bit confusing in terms of syntax. So here I create a function, like I've done before. I call it point constructor, which is a weird name. And I'm using this here, even though I haven't defined it in the context of an existing object. So what the hell is going on here? Well, if I were to call point constructor like this, it would work. Because if I call a function and I don't give it the object to apply to, if I don't give it this object, well, the default this object is going to be a global object. If you're in the context of the web browser, it's going to be the document. But that's not the way I want to use this, of course. I want to use this because I want to create point objects. And the way to do this is by using this thing, new, point constructor. So this seems weird. I'm using the function call here, but I'm sticking new in front. What does this do? It's very simple. It creates a new empty object. And it calls this function on this new object. And so now, in fact, in this context, I have an object that is the new object, and this refers to that object. So by doing this, I'm creating a new object for which I have assigned its two coordinates to zero. Okay, but in my object here, I didn't put a move by method. And it doesn't feel right to put a move by function, a different one, a new one, in each and every new point object. I want to all of them share the same move by function. Well, the way to do this is the function is an object, so it has its own properties. And one magic one is called prototype. And everything I put in prototype will be also available to the objects created from that constructor. So, I'm not going into details, you can look this up online, but now, the fact that I've put moveby, this function moveby, part of the prototype of my constructor here, every time I create a new point, P, not only will have the x and y I've created here, but it also, in a sense, inherits the stuff from its prototype. So I can do p.moveby here, and now I have access to this. But I have only one instance of this function for all the points that I created this way. So this is a little bit disturbing because of the way the syntax works. It's actually less disturbing when you understand how things happen in the back, because it tells you more directly what is actually happening, that the most object-oriented languages, which hide things behind different syntactic sugar. The point is that you can do very powerful things with that, because it's object-based as opposed to object-oriented, if we take Peter Wagner classification. It's very powerful. Now, with great power comes great responsibility, and of course, you will go crazy at the beginning, especially because it's a non-typed language. So, you don't compile, the system tells you what's wrong, you discover what's wrong when you try things out. It's a process. Okay, now I want to move on to a set of tools here. So again, if our goal is to build applications that run inside a web browser and that talk to each other, well, not only do we need to build stuff in the form of web pages with JavaScript inside of those pages, but we also need the server. So building web servers is not something particularly exciting. It's painful, and usually it's done in a different language than JavaScript, which is the language you use in the browser. And I don't know, I'm getting old, but I have a hard time juggling, between multiple languages. So, fairly recently, there's a thing called Node.js that has come up, which I find really great, because it gives you the ability to program servers in JavaScript. So you're using the same language both on the server side and on the browser side, which is relaxing for the mind. The other thing is Node.js is essentially based on the notion of an engine that is optimized to efficiently deal with asynchronous events. And that is good, because when we build interactive systems, that's what we want. The reason it was built for this was like this was not to build interactive stuff in particular, it was to build a server that would scale with heavy loads. And essentially, if you want to do a web server, which is something that's going to be hit by a bunch of web browsers and needs to build a response every time it receives a request, if you want this to scale, well, what people have done until now, if you look at Apache, is use multiple threads. Typically, a request arrives, you create a new thread for that request, so it can handle multiple requests in parallel. Have you ever programmed with threads?
Yes.
Yes? Did you like it? Yes? Well, you're weird. I mean, your email is organized and you like threads? I don't know. Okay, well, that's different. Now, programming with threads can quickly fry your mind, or at least it does to mine, because of race conditions. You know, if each thread is very independent, which is the case for a server that only serves static pages like the Apache server does, but if things get, not independent, you have logs and it gets pretty complicated. So, what Node.js does is say, forget this thread thing. What we're going to do is something that is quick at reacting to an event, and it's going to be event-based. And so one of the basic constructs in Node is something that emits event. And so there's a JavaScript class, if you wish, called event emitter. And essentially, when I create a new emitter object, a new object that can emit objects, there's two things essentially I can do with it. I can have it emit an event, so an event has a type, if you wish, that is a string, and it has a content that is any object. And then, completely separately in another piece of code, I can say, well, when this emitter receives an event with type hello, here is what you have to do. You call this function, and the data that was emitted here gets passed to that function. And here, what I'm saying is hello with the content. And what happens is that in Node, everything is built around this concept of events. So when you have an object deep down that has an error condition, instead of raising an exception or doing something, it emits an event that says error. Now this implies a programming style where a lot of the time, when you call something that in the end calls an event, you also typically have to pass a function that will be called when this event eventually gets handled. And so you end up all the time writing things like doing something and then the function here that will be called when this happens. If you program in Swing, and I know you have, this is really what you do with the listeners, right? When you create the listeners for a mouse event or click event on a button, you pass a piece of code that will be called. So that's the way we're steering, except it's really all over the place. And they also have another powerful construct, which are streams, which are general event-driven streams that generalizes the notion of writing to a file on disk, or writing to a socket on the network, or even writing to a string in memory. And so all of this is a very small set of constructs that are, you know, a little bit unusual at first, but that work very well together. And very efficient. In fact, some very big websites are powered by Node.js. So here's an HTTP server in Node. That's all the code you need. Now, I'm cheating a little bit because I'm using a module called Express, but even if you wanted to do it in plain Node, it would work. So I create a server, and I said, you know, when the user is retrieving the slash, the root, call this function, and this function is called with the request I'm receiving and the response I want to send. And I say, well, send the response that says hello world. And then I can show you that, but we're running out of time. So then this is a server that does one thing. If I hit the root of the server, it will give me back hello world, and that's it. By adding this line here, I'm telling it that if there is nothing else to do, every time I receive a request for a path, go find a file under public that will have this name and give that file back. So I can serve HTML files, which is just 6 lines of code here.
Okay, so we can build a web server that can serve static pages. Now, I'm going to want the page in my browser to communicate with the server, not just like loading the page from the server, but you know, if I'm doing a chat tool, for example, I want the web browser, the Node server to communicate, and the Node server to send things back to all those that are connecting. Now, with HTML5 came a standard for socket-based communication from within a web page. And in the context of Node, it's encapsulated in a module called Socket.io, which you load both on the server on the client. So here is a very simple chat system. Here is pretty much all the code on the server. I use Socket.io, I listen on port 80, and I say, well, when there is a new connection, this is an event handler. When there's a new connection on my socket, it receives a message called connection, call this function. This function will be called with the client as parameter, which has information about who is connecting, its address, so you can do authentication and stuff like that. And so in that function, now that I have a client object, I say, well, when this client sends me a message, so again, event handling here, call this function, and you see this business of nesting functions inside functions, which don't think too much about it, otherwise it's going to hurt your brain. But essentially, when this new client receives a message called MSG with some data, what I want is to send it to all other clients. That's the rule with the chat, right? Receive a message, send it to everybody else. So client, in fact, this object I'm being given here has a property called broadcast. It knows which other clients are connected, so by doing client broadcast emit this message, in fact, it will send a message to all the clients that are connected at the moment. On the client side, remember, the client side is a web page. So it's a web page that will have from your box to display the chat and the box to enter the chat. So I put here only the script. And here's the other script you need to do that. Connect to the server. When I receive a message that I've indeed connected to the server, I'm going to say hello to the server. Remember, when I emit towards the server something that says message, it will be sent to everybody else. So this will say hello to everybody else. And then when I receive a message from the server, here I've used jQuery to say, well, add the data, which is the text of the message, to the text area in my web page that is the chat box. And so that's all you need to do. With that, you have with these two pieces of code, you have essentially a chat system. Okay, even better. I showed that briefly last year. ShareJS. So ShareJS is a system that implements operational transformation for text editing and editing of JSON objects. A JSON object is pretty much every kind of object you manipulate in JavaScript you can represent as a JSON object. And so that's the very simplest use of it, where you open a ShareJS session I don't want to go into all the details of the parameters here, but I get the text area that will hold my text that is being shared. And when I open ShareJS and the thing actually gets open, this function gets called with a document. And all I have to do is to attach this document to the text area in my web browser. And so ShareJS comes with its own server built with Node that you can run. So you build that, you run that server, and then in a page you put that, and you can have shared editing, concurrent editing with the virtual transform running for you. Now you can build your own server if you wish, there's a richer API for shared editing of general objects, not just text. Now, one more tool that I find interesting, not saying you have to use it, just giving you a set of things. This is Node WebKit. Now, this is a thing that it took me a while to figure out what this was. The idea is that it takes the Node server I was talking about, and it takes a WebKit browser, so a browser, but it puts the two of them in one application. Why would you do that? Well, they did this because they wanted to build desktop applications, but using web stuff. And so the idea is that the windows of your application, the content is done as web pages, but these web pages come from the server that is inside the same application. And the advantage of this is that you have one application, for one thing. The second thing is that it gives you, through JavaScript, access to some native desktop things, like the menu bars and the menus and the taskbar if you're on Windows, or the dock if you're on the Mac, so some, and even the file system. But what I found is that because when you do web-based stuff, you have a lot of constraints because of the security issues. So you know the same origin policy, that the script in your page cannot load stuff from a different web server than the one you're on, and things like this. So, and it's becoming worse and worse. Now here, because the server is bundled with the client, in a sense, none of this applies. And then what you can do is deploy your application with this, and have the Node servers talk to each other. And this gives
more flexibility than using the things I've showed before for using a standard web servers. And one of the things you can do in particular between two node servers, you can also do it between a web browser and a node server, is using dnode, which gives you remote, well, usually we say remote procedure call, here I call it remote function call for Node.js and the browser. So the way it works here, I have a server, I create a dnode object, and in that object, I give it a list, there's only one here, of functions, and the idea is that this function will be callable from the client. So I call here, I use here a function called transform. It takes a string and a callback. So it will take the string, replace every pair of vowels by OO, and turn the whole thing uppercase. This is a really stupid example. And when it's done this to the string, it will call the callback with the result. Now the callback is going to be a function on the client. So the client code here, same thing, I connect to the dnode thing, and I say, well, when I receive a remote call, then I want, when I connect to the remote service, call this function with the remote object as a parameter, and I have access to all the functions I defined in my server here. So transform was there, I can call remote.transform, I give it the string beep, and I say, well, when you're done, call this function, which is a callback, and this callback will just display the result and close the connection. And so when I run this, I'm calling beep on the server turns it into boop and sends it back. But this is done with function calls, so it hides all the nastiness of sending objects back and forth and referencing callbacks and all that. So it's pretty cool. Last thing you'll need to debug. So that's another cool thing, is that every browser has a cool debugger, web inspector, and it allows you to, you know, do breakpoints and a whole bunch of things that you find in the debuggers. Yes.
If you use another WebKit, can you actually use this?
So, how do you debug in Node.js? Well, you can run Node with a debug parameter on your script, and then you have text-based debugging, which is boring. But there is a module called the Node Inspector. And so what Node Inspector allows you to do is you launch Node with a dash debug or dash debug break. You launch the Node Inspector server in the background, and then you take any browser, you go to this address, and you get this debugger, but for your node code. So you're debugging your node code with WebKit inspection. And I tried it and it works beautifully. So, if you do debug, it will just launch. If you do debug break, it will stop automatically at the beginning of your app, which sometimes you need to do if you want to look at some things or whatever. Okay, so that was very fast. What I would like you to do for this course is two things, as we said. First, pick an article, any article that is listed on the webpage of the course. If you want to work on another article, you just have to ask me before if it's okay. I would like this to be an individual exercise to read the article, understand it, ask me if you have questions, and prepare a short presentation to give to the class about the article. So, I don't know, 5 to 10 minutes.
The exams,
are you
ready?
I'm sorry?
Exams.
Yes.
Yeah, the deadline on the exams.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
The deadline?
It can be, we can give ourselves some more time if that's a problem.
I mean, I think for the paper, for reading and presenting the paper, I don't want to wait too long, because I know you can have other things to do. So, I think it's a bit short probably to do it by the last session of the class, which was my original sort of goal. It will be around the exam for the presentation of the paper. The other thing I would like you to do for this, I think it would be good if you worked in pairs, probably, or you can work alone if you want, but it's to, and the goal here is just for you to experiment what it is to use preferably the tools I talked about. If you want to do it differently, you can. To build a small groupware system. So, you know, something simple. The goal here is not to be, I mean, you can be creative, but it's just so you see the kind of issues you run into to create these kind of things. So, I listed a list of examples here, but there's more. I was not very inspired, but something like, for example, a shared drawing tool, so you can do doodling or you know, just drawing things.
Pessimist or optimist?
I'm sorry?
Pessimistic or optimist?
I'll you decide. You decide. Shared browsing, so, you know, this is actually solving a real world problem. You want to browse and have another person or other persons see the same things as you do. So you want to synchronize the browsing. So if you click on the link, I want everybody to go to the new page. If I scroll, everybody should scroll. The challenge here is how do you make this work for any web page? So it shouldn't be just on pages that you create, but it has to be somehow injecting code into existing pages. And I can give ideas on how to do that. Same idea of annotating pages. It's very easy on a web page to add screen-wide sort of layer on top of it, so then you can have drawing on it, so annotation. Multi-room chat is a classic example of a communication system. Really anything that is a groupware system. And before you get started, it would be good that you tell me what you want to do, and I tell you if I think it's reasonable. it's easy to have a good idea that then turns into a nightmare to implement. So I can give you advice on that. Okay?
For presentations, we need to choose a different article for the.
So you need a groupware tool to assign the articles, is that what you're saying?
I was just asking if two persons want to.
Well, yeah, I think it's more fun if everybody picks a different one.
Yeah, but we can have conflicts, you know.
Yeah, but don't you see each other once in a while?
Can you solve the conflicts?
I can solve the conflicts. So if two people pick the same article, none of you can have it. Does this work?
No.
Yeah, until we run out of articles.
Oh, that that will be a long time. Okay, well, I don't know, I can put a thing where you make your choice of article and whoever picks it first wins. Okay, works like that?
So you have to send you an email with the title of the article?
Yeah, I think that would be the best thing. And I'll put them up on the... Well, I think it would be good to make your choice by next week. Next week, I am not giving the class. So, Mehdi Ami from IMC is going to teach a class on collaborative virtual environments. So, it's going to be immersive 3D and all that stuff. And then I'll be back the following week. I mean, it's not on the way, I'm just busy giving another demo of our wild room. And I also feel like, you know, there are two courses that we had to cancel because there were not people interested. And so I also wanted to give the people who would have taught this class an opportunity to talk a little bit about their stuff to you guys. And so with Mehdi, I think it was a good opportunity to have him talk about the virtual environment stuff.
For the project,
yes?
Do they need to be all be web-based, or we can?
They don't. If you want to use something else, let me know what you are thinking of, because again, I don't want you to get started on something that will then be too hard to work with. So, do you have an idea already, or it's just a...
For example, we write a program in C or in Python or something like that.
Well, in C, frankly, I'm not sure I would recommend that unless you're really fluent with... The problem is the networking stuff, you know, is always a pain. So that's why using higher level things, so Python has very good packages for network stuff, so it'll be fine. Something I didn't mention, but Socket.io, for example, works on top of WebSockets as well as other transports. It has a thing that it does automatically, which is that if either the server disappears or the client disappears, it reconnects automatically next time you launch it. So you don't have to restart all the clients when you restart the server and things like this. This seems like, you know, a small detail, but especially when you're developing, it's really great. So if you use too low-level stuff like C, you're going to spend a lot of time on networking stuff that is not exciting. Python, sure, why not? Okay? Java, I don't know enough of what's in Java for this kind of things. So if you're fluent and think you know exactly what tools you have at your disposal, I'm fine with that too. Okay? Yes?
Can we build on something that is already invented? I mean, how to improve what is already there?
Sure, why not? What I would ask you is when you have picked your project to tell me what you have in mind, so I can tell you if I think it's... So, I mean, the thing is, you know, this thing, you'll find a zillion of them already out there. So, of course, I don't want you to take one and say, here. But, you know, take an existing one as a basis and add features to it.
So adding features is okay.
Yeah, that would be okay. It's not necessarily less work.